Friends, may I call this session to order, please? Let's settle first the matter of this microphone. Is it coming through? You want louder, softer, more dulcet tones, perhaps? All right, thank you. Welcome to this Sunstone session, sponsored by Dialogue, a journal of Mormon thought. We are happy to participate here at Sunstone, and we at Dialogue endorse entirely everything that's been said as last night, urging people to support Sunstone and create more fervor for it. Include Dialogue in your thoughts of increased fervor in the name of good causes. You're invited to drop around the book exhibit area and re-up on your subscription to Dialogue. And examine your conscience closely on that, please, before you leave. Glad to chair this session on how Mormons have helped perpetuate the war in Iraq, what we can do to help to end it, to help end it. Unfortunately, one of our panelists could not be here, Brent Rushforth, and we're sorry for that. And our two remaining panelists, Robert Reese and Francis Manlove, will fill in, and there will be more time for questions and answers and discussion afterward. I would like to say that in the tradition of Dialogue, of examining both sides of Mormon issues, we recognize that one side is being represented here by the panelists, or as I think you will see. If there are views to the contrary, we would welcome them most heartily in the discussion session and would like to hear them. Our first speaker today will actually be Francis Lee Manlove. The two panelists have agreed among themselves that hers would be the best to lead off. And she is, as you see, one of the founders of a Dialogue and served on the first editorial team and has a kind of hallowed honor because of that. Presently lives in Oregon. If you notice carefully that the three persons representing Dialogue here today are from the West Coast, California, Oregon, and Washington, and what does that say? At any rate, Francis will now address us we'll turn the time to her.
I'm hoping, is that good, or is that is right in front of my mouth, like that? Okay. Now, how's that? Not so good? Now. Better? Better? Okay. Please, in the back, wave your hands if you can't hear me, okay? Anytime. Please. Please. Okay. What I'm going to do for my part is I'm going to start by talking just for a couple of minutes about a peacemaking experiment that's going on the Oregon coast. And then I'm going to get into more the meat of this panel and come up with a couple of suggestions about what we might be doing. First, let me describe Peace Village. Peace Village is an experiment in peacemaking on the Oregon coast. It is a week-long interfaith day camp for kids aged 6 to 12, designed jointly by the Peace and Conflict Studies Department of Pacific University and a congregational church on the Oregon coast. During 1 week each summer, as many as 60 adults, and that's true, work for the benefit of 40 to 60 kids, and they're racially and culturally diverse. I've volunteered there for the last few years, and several of my grandkids have participated each year, so we go every year. Now, the inspiration for Peace Village comes quite simply from the nonviolent teachings and example of Jesus. The signature quote of Peace Village is Gandhi's injunction that if we are to attain real peace in the world, we must begin with the children. The foundational philosophy of Peace Village is a conviction that all the major religious teachings of the world, at their core, have a common message, a message of peace and compassion. And a favorite story. This is the favorite story of Peace Village. It's a wonderful old Native American myth. The myth tells us that within each of us has two wolves living inside us, struggling against one another for survival. One wolf is belligerent and violent. The other is peaceful and compassionate. Which one survives? The one we feed. If you were to drop by one morning, you would see about 60 kids sitting on the floor, gathered around a storyteller. Then they break up into age groups led by a university student, and the classes begin. One class is on nonviolent conflict resolution, where kids learn nonviolent options for when they are personally confronted with threats of violence. They are taught skills to fend off bullying behavior and avoid fights. In one room, you might see a Buddhist master teaching the kids about mindfulness or walking meditation. And in another, a yoga instructor teaching them how to be an arched cat, or as a group, how to make a 20-foot snake. The kids in the art room might be making musical instruments, or as they did this year, Buddhist peace flags to drape over the cultural center. You might listen to a Jewish rabbi showing the kids how to write shalom in Hebrew and explaining the profound meaning of Shabbat. Last year, you would have seen a Muslim imam talking about Ramadan and explaining the prayer cycle and showing the kids a prayer rug. Outside, a Native American shaman helps the group create a sacred space in the medicine wheel. Each year, they learn about the life of one peace hero. Jesus, Gandhi, Dorothy Day, Martin Luther King, Thich Nhat Hanh, the Dalai Lama, etc. There's an afternoon at the beach where teams of kids build peace villages, and on another day a hike for the older kids kayaking. Nutrition, ecology, media analysis, and a culminating ceremony complete the curriculum. The games are fun and the snacks are superb. With the media, schools, and pop culture providing endless food for the violent wolf, Peace Village is designed to nourish the peaceful and compassionate one. Peace Village goes out of its way to be cross-cultural, interfaith, interrelational, interracial, international, to show commonalities and increase understanding across barriers. Barriers that often end up serving as dividing lines for hatred and violence. Now, let me tell you what you would not hear if you dropped by Peace Village. What isn't mentioned is the war in Iraq, military recruitment, or the conflict in the Middle East. There is no call to demonstrations, no direct action, no civil disobedience. The intentional strategy of Peace Village has been to avoid topical controversy and to teach the deeper lessons of peace. It's an important point. The organizers of Peace Village, both from the faith communities and from the universities, believe that one of the biggest obstacles to peacemaking is the prevailing concept that peace is a liberal issue, not a bipartisan one. This allows half the population to dismiss the concept of peace without ever addressing it. They want to redefine peace as an apolitical agenda, as a humanist cause, instead of a political one. The approach is to join with people of diverse backgrounds, including conservatives, and move to the universality of peace. The strategy is based on the assumption that people who learn deep respect for natural beauty, the interdependence of all life, the diversity of cultures, and spiritual compassion will naturally oppose war, injustice, and environmental degradation. How did peace making become such a partisan issue? How did we come to this dark turning in our country? These questions are at the heart of this panel, and before I address them directly, I have a modest proposal, the first of two proposals in this talk. I propose that we seriously consider adopting Reverend William Sloan Coffin's definition of a good patriot. There are three kinds of patriots, Coffin says. Two bad and one good. The two bad ones are the uncritical lovers and the loveless critics. A good patriot is not an uncritical lover of country, and a good patriot is not a loveless critic. No. Good patriots carry on a lover's quarrel with their country, a reflection of God's lover's quarrel with the world. Good patriots don't just salute the flag, and they don't burn it either. They carry on a lover's quarrel with their country, just as God carries on a lover's quarrel with this world. Someone is going to pass out to you copies of that definition of a good patriot, so they'll be coming down your aisle right now. The definition is important because it opens up space for dialogue. It refuses to let a loveless critic, which tells us the U.S. is always dead wrong, shut down the discussion. It refuses to let the uncritical lover, who tells us love it or leave it, shut down the discussion. A good patriot carries on a lover's quarrel with our country, with reflection of God's lover's quarrel with our world. In this time of warring certainties, and I think it is warring certainties, this kind of a definition might open up a zone of freedom where differences can be expressed, explored, and worked through in mutual understanding and growth. It also might open up space to simply speak and pray about the current situation, to remind both individual members and the church as a body of their sacred prophetic role to speak truth to power, remembering that history has taught us it is possible for a church to become a bad patriot, an uncritical lover of country. I believe in the spirit of a good patriot that our nation has taken an extensive and profoundly dark turn. You have all heard the litany: torture, preemptive war, denial of habeas corpus, hundreds of thousands dead, and so on. I think one of the reasons we're in this perilous place is because of this administration's manipulation of Christian rhetoric. Holiness rhetoric is foundational for Mr. Bush's worldview. The war has been cloaked in the name and the symbols of faith, and American foreign policy has been conflated with God's purposes. Now, listen to these quotes from President Bush. You are with us or against us. Our responsibility before history is already clear: to answer these attacks and rid the world of evil. Rid the world of evil. Can you imagine a better definition of war without end? War everlasting? More quotes. Our nation has been chosen by God and commissioned by history to be a model of justice before the world. Another. There will be a monumental struggle of good versus evil, but good will prevail. Another. History has called America and our allies to action. The nation must go forth to confound the designs of evil men, because our calling as a blessed country is to make the world better. Mr. Bush even co-opts the Gospel of John and talks about how America stands as a beacon of light to the world, and that the light shines in the darkness and the darkness has not overcome it. But the light in John's Gospel is the work of God, the light of Christ. President Bush told us that our attack on Iraq would be in the highest moral traditions of our country. thus linking preemptive war on Iraq to his understanding of Christian morality. He may not realize that for several centuries, Christians refused to serve in the military. Holiness rhetoric is foundational for Mr. Bush's worldview, and it is bad theology. It confuses church and nation and God's purpose with the interests of American foreign policy. Underpinning Mr. Bush's worldview is certainly not pacifist theology, nor just war arguments. It is crusader theology. The conviction that God sanctions war when the enemy represents great evil. It makes God a kind of mascot, a tribal god. For complex historical and religious reasons, Americans, and especially Mormons, have found it easy to view America as a new Israel, where God's mandates are carried out in the world. A kind of expansive, theologically driven manifest destiny. In this view, America has an exceptional character and mission and a presumptive innocence. This theology of superiority, chosenness, divine favoritism provides an underpinning for those who are in power. Furthermore, the irony of a nation's believing that it's been chosen of God is the fact that other nations believe the same thing. Inevitably, each side cloaks itself in the myths of righteousness. The notion that God has a favorite or a few favorite nations is an ethnocentric belief, a superstition that needs to be retired. It is an ideology that has caused incredible human grief and misery. Many in this country believe that God is on our side as our soldiers are fighting the Muslim insurgents. Muslim militants think Allah is on their side. The dualism of good versus evil has been co-opted by both sides. The high moral tone the Bush administration takes about our foreign policy is an obstacle to examining our own national conscience. If we really are fighting the axis of evil and we are the agents of good, what more is there to say? We all like to pretend that our violence is virtuous. Fear steals our imagination, and public policy molded by fear always suppresses genuine ethical discussion. By framing this war in the language the president frames every American who questions his policy as opposing good, the good that must triumph over evil, debate stops, democracy is crippled, a difference of opinion is not just another idea, it is an expression of evil. In calling up the apocalyptic world of good versus evil, there is no neutral ground. The self-righteousness of our nation threatens our capacity for self-criticism. This not only cripples dialogue on a national level, but also within our own congregations. The self-righteousness of our nation feeds religious self-righteousness. This is a totalitarian hermeneutic of right against wrong or good against evil, and it takes no prisoners, it shows no mercy, and it works. It bolsters fear and makes any other alternative sound foolhardy and dangerous. The tactic of fear is all about eliminating the right of choice. It asserts that only bombs and guns can solve our problem and make us safe. The rhetoric of no other way, of ultimatum. But of course there's another way, another choice. This kind of zealotry sees choice as the enemy and dialogue as unpatriotic. Not only is dialogue part of real patriotism, but it is one of the founding principles of our country. Now, the strategy of dividing the world into good guys and evildoers has strong emotional appeal, and it's a very ancient and pervasive worldview. Actually, it was a heresy at one time, Manichaeism heresy. The dualism meets the primal need for a scapegoat, it meets our need for a scapegoat, and creates the impression that complicated problems are really quite simple. Dualists generally associate the kingdom of God and the kingdom of light with their own views, and the kingdom of darkness with their enemies. Thus, to confess faith in God is at the same time to declare war on the enemies of God as if they emanated from this some other source, it becomes easy to use God as an umbrella to cover violence. War makes demonizing the enemy easy. Only by demonizing our enemies can we kill them with impunity. When we are afraid and we divide the world into the good and the evil, it is easy to justify things we might not justify in other circumstances. Demonizing Iraqis makes it easier to bomb them, to break down the doors of their homes, to imprison them without charges and without notifying their families, and to use torture. Enemies are essential to dualistic worldviews. In this view, the fate of the earth depends on the willingness of good people to do things they would not ordinarily do, including violence and torture, in order to keep evil people from taking over. Now I'm warming up to my second suggestion. My second suggestion involves taking two significant events in Mormon history, yoking them together, and coming up with a vivid lesson in peacemaking. A little background. The 20th century made it pristine clear, absolutely clear, that ordinary people are capable of horrendous acts. As social scientists have pointed out, the capacity to do evil resides in us all. Research has even spelled out four circumstances that encourage this expression. They include being one of a group, being in an environment experienced as alien and dangerous, and being an overall climate where there is little or no accountability. These circumstances pretty much describe the situation in Iraq, and specifically at Abu Ghraib. In other words, those who create and support circumstances, namely Americans, namely us, bear responsibility for the horrors at Abu Ghraib and elsewhere. We must not protect ourselves by pretending either that atrocities didn't happen or that the evil that allows these barbarities to occur resides in a few bad soldiers, a few bad apples. These atrocities are, in fact, a direct consequence of the logic and the theological moral surrounding the occupation. It is not a few bad apples. It's a bad barrel. Now, my second proposal. I propose that the church forcefully repudiate the construction of otherness, the demonizing of others, the good guys versus the bad guys, the us versus them worldview. I believe the church could, right now, seize a unique opportunity presented by its unique history. Let me explain. Mormon history vividly highlights the ugliness of them versus us worldview. And from both sides, the victim and the victimizer. Remember, no other church in the history of our country, I believe, has ever been under an extermination order. An extermination order. Governor Boggs was clear about who the good guys were and who were the evil doers when he ordered that, quote, the Mormons must be treated as enemies and must be exterminated or driven from the state. Their outrages are beyond all description. Mormons know, deep down and personal, what persecution is. Now for the other side of the coin. Think about the Mountain Meadows Massacre. Richard E. Turley, in an article for next month's Ensign, tells us the Mormon settlers and some of their allies murdered 120 members of a wagon train. Turley says, as directed, the youngest children and the wounded left the wagon corral first, driven in two wagons, followed by women and children on foot. The men and older boys filed out last, each escorted by an armed militiaman. The procession marched for a mile or so until, at a prearranged signal, each militiaman turned and shot the immigrant next to him. The horrific crime, which spared only 17 children aged 6 and under, occurred at the Highland Valley called Mountain Meadows. The victims, most of them from Arkansas, were on their way to California with dreams of a bright future. This September 11th will be the 6th anniversary of the attack on the Twin Towers and the Pentagon. And coincidentally, this September 11th will be the 150th anniversary of the Mountain Meadows Massacre. It was a killing field, a massacre on September 11th. Turley asks, how could this have happened? How could members of the church have participated in such a crime, and how could those who deplored vigilante action against their own people in Missouri and Illinois follow virtually the same pattern of violence against others, but on a deadlier scale? Turley adds, the majority of perpetrators led decent, nonviolent lives before and after the massacre. And we're not surprised. I absolutely believe that. It's another example of the lesson of the last century. Good people can do horrific things. So speaking directly from their own historical experience here in America, Mormons can say they understand, maybe uniquely understand, the destructiveness of demonizing a group of people. They have had it done to them, and they have done it to others. And it is pure hell being on either the victim or the victimizer. They have been on both sides. They know what fear can do. They know what mobs can do. They know that given the right circumstances, ordinary people can do horrific things. Mormons can speak with clarity and speak with moral authority about how pernicious it is for a group of people to demonize or be demonized. They can reject all wholesale labeling of the other as enemy, and with the moral authority that comes from this lived history, Mormons can renounce the construction of otherness, the demonizing of one group. They can insist that we misunderstand evil if we associate it simply with our enemies and don't look into the darkness of our own hearts. Mormons can testify about another way of looking at the world, one that talks about peace and restoration and healing and forgiveness and mercy. The gospel proclaims that God is no respecter of persons and that has as much love of Iraqis as for Americans. When Iraqis or Americans die, God weeps. Jesus abides with the terrified residents of Baghdad as much as he does with our soldiers. Cast no one in the role of enemy. This is a part of the great commandment. It is impossible to create or sustain peace when we divide the world around us into allies and enemies. Jesus spoke it, Jesus lived it and shared it. Mormons understand it firsthand from their short history. The gospel rejects labeling the others as enemy. The gospel affirms the way of nonviolence. Mormons, like all Christians, have a searching distrust of violence, a strong presumption against war. There is a moral imperative to seek peace whenever possible. Jesus knows no national boundaries. Loving one's enemy is at the heart of the gospel. And peacemaking is not one among other tasks of a Christian community. It is at the heart of it. And it is an essential component of its mission. When a Christian decides to take up arms, it is done with humility, as a last resort, a sense of the pervasiveness of sin on all sides, and with a heavy heart, never with triumphalism. I'm not talking about pacifism, because there will always be differences about going to war, both when and if. But war must always be a last resort, not a preemptive one. Everyone should be united by a deep mistrust of violence, an understanding that all wars are civil wars, since we are all brothers and sisters. A refusal to give white hats to ourselves and black hats to anyone who disagrees with us, and a public avowal that loving one's enemies is at the heart of the gospel. This time of dark turning in America may be one of those historic times for the nation and the church when silence is sin. The impetus behind this panel is the hope that you and I, each in our own crucial way, will work for and witness for and pray for the things that make for peace in our lives and in our country. In summary, my two modest suggestions are, first, adopt the definition of a good patriot as one who carries on a lover's quarrel with their country, a reflection of God's lover's quarrel with the world, and second, embrace both sides of the church's history, both Governor Boggs' order of extermination and the Mountain Meadows Massacre, and become a voice of conscience for the country, rejecting all labeling of others as enemies, and affirming the unity of the whole human community. Remember, Jesus never said, "Blessed are the peace lovers." We're all peace lovers. It's very easy to be a peace lover. Jesus said, "Blessed are the peacemakers." Blessed are the peacemakers. Thank you.
I'm happy to introduce Robert Reese now from California, and as most many of you know, the editor of, or the chief of the second editorial team that took over Dialogue, and he's therefore one of the editor emeriti of Dialogue. Robert?
Thank you, Levi. I think all of you can see why when I decided to do this panel, my first choice for someone to participate was Francis. Francis has been for many years one of the clearest and most articulate and most honest voices among us. I don't know how many of you recognize something that happened when Francis was reading her paper, but in my lifetime, I didn't expect the Ensign ever to have that kind of an article in it. And what a wonderful thing it is, and what a breath of fresh air to have that kind of candor. And I think what a tribute to this community of people here and beyond here who have been willing to raise these issues and to open this dialogue in the hope that at some point that kind of an article might appear. And I think it's definitely a breath of fresh air. I could not begin my remarks without paying homage to one of the great peacemakers of the past 30 or 40 years among us, and that is our dear brother, Gene England, who in his book, Making Peace, I think articulates as clearly and as passionately what it means to be a peacemaker as a Latter-day Saint. The other panelist that I chose was my good friend Brent Rushforth, and as mentioned, Brent could not be here because he is working with some of the internees at Guantanamo, and he called yesterday morning to say that one of his clients that he was representing, who is on a hunger strike and who is being force-fed by the military, had become quite ill, and Brent had to go to Guantanamo to attend to him. He said, "But you can share this story with people who are at the conference." He said, "This man's name is Muhammad. He's a very devout Muslim, very introspective, and whose greatest desire is to live a life that's pleasing to Allah. He reacted against the disrespectful treatment of the Quran by some of his captors, and because of that, some group called the EFT, the Emergency Force Team, came in and roughed him up a bit. And so Brent came in shortly after that and decided that he would take a risk. As you know, part of the strategy at Guantanamo was to play off the Christians against the Muslims to denigrate that religion. And there is some understandable animosity among those Muslims toward Christians. But Brent said, "I decided to take a chance, and so I started telling him about my own faith." And my Christian Egyptian translator said, "You know, I don't think that's a very good idea." And Brent said, "Well, I'm going to risk it." And so he started telling him about what he believed, and he started telling him about Joseph Smith and about Joseph Smith's persecution and how Joseph Smith was put in prison at Liberty Jail and how Joseph Smith was ultimately killed by his enemies. And he told him about the Mormons going on their trek west, As he was telling this story about in the middle of it, the Egyptian translator again is very nervous and said, just a minute, I need to interrupt you. He said to Brant, you're walking a very thin line here. And Brant said, let it go. So he said, I continued for about an hour telling him about my faith. And he said, after I did so, he said, he looked at me and he opened up like a flower. Those are Brent's terms. And he talked about, this Muhammad talked about the relationship that he saw between Christianity and Islam. And he said, we have the same father, Abraham. And Brent said, there was a bonding between us. So he said, you can tell the people at Sunstone that the gospel has been preached in Guantanamo Bay. Let me begin with a quote from President David O. McKay. We see that war is incompatible with Christ's teachings. The gospel of Jesus Christ is the gospel of peace. War is the antithesis and produces hate. It is vain to try and reconcile war with true Christianity. The war in Iraq may end up being one of the most damaging and destructive wars in American history. At present, it has lasted longer than the Second World War, and some military spokesmen have estimated that we could be in Iraq for decades. Although the Vietnam War was damaging to the reputation of the United States, much of the most serious fallout from that war was limited to Southeast Asia. The war in Iraq has already exacted much greater damage to our image and reputation worldwide, especially among, but not limited to, Islamic nations. The long-term effect of the war on our own and future generations is unknown, but unless we find some way to extricate ourselves from it, and there is some indication that even if we could, there are signs that it could be catastrophic. Some may consider it unfair and even disturbing to suggest that Latter-day Saints have helped perpetuate the war in Iraq, and presumptuous to suggest that we could help end it. But that is exactly what I propose. I will begin by discussing ways in which Latter-day Saints living in the United States, and especially in the Intermountain area, have helped support and sustain the war. I identify six specific attitudes and actions as a culture that I believe have contributed to our going into and staying in Iraq. The first is by being rigidly partisan. Since Utah, Idaho, and Wyoming all have sizable Mormon populations and are considered the reddest, that is, the most Republican states in the Union, at least in leading all other states in their support of the current administration and consistently showing the strongest support for the war, one could reasonably assume that partisan politics is a determining factor in Mormon support of the war in Iraq. From the beginning of the war, there has been a relationship between the Republican support of the war nationally and support among Mormons regionally. According to Timothy Egan, quote, all of the administration's perceived failures, including the war in Iraq, Hurricane Katrina, and the budget deficit, go through a different filter in these Bush strongholds. Speaking specifically of Utah, Egan adds, still, because voters in the state are strongly religious, with a huge majority belonging to the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and strongly Republican, the well of support for Mr. Bush is deeper here than in almost any other place in the country. The Salt Lake Tribune reported that a 2-year compilation of Gallup polls showed, quote, American Mormons are more than any other religious group over that period, believed the United States was right to invade Iraq. As the support of the president's own party has waned in recent months, so has support among Idaho, Utah, and Wyoming residents, even though with the decline, their support is still the highest in the nation. Predominantly, Mormon politicians have been strong supporters of the war in Iraq. In terms of the initial authorization to go to war, all 5 LDS senators and 9 of 11 members of the House voted affirmatively. The only 2 LDS members of the House who voted against the resolution were cousins Mark Udall of Colorado and Tom Udall of New Mexico, both Democrats. Not only have LDS Republican members of Congress overwhelmingly supported the war, some have been vociferous in criticizing those who have opposed the war. This is especially true of Senator Orrin Hatch. In May 2004, Hatch blasted critics of the war. Quote, It is because of the fortitude of this president and this administration that we have stood up to terrorism all over the world. These critics fail to acknowledge that our coalition has overthrown two regimes. We've captured and killed almost two-thirds of the known al-Qaeda terrorist leaders around the world. We've captured or killed 46 of the 55 most wanted in Iraq, including Saddam Hussein. We've disrupted terror cells on most continents. More recently, Hatch has voted against resolutions calling for the redeployment of U.S. troops out of Iraq. As support for the war has waned among the general populace, several Latter-day Saint senators, notably Harry Reid, the majority leader, and Gordon Smith, Republican of Oregon, have become outspoken critics of the war. Number two, we have helped perpetuate the war by not being fully informed about it. I was surprised recently in speaking with several Mormons of distinction who had graduated from prestigious Eastern universities to discover that they knew practically nothing of our government's, quote, extreme rendition policies, including its illegal kidnapping of suspected terrorists, the incarceration and torture of such individuals in undisclosed prisons outside the United States, some of which are located in countries we've identified as our enemies in the war on terror, and the violation of the Geneva Conventions in regard to detainees at Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo. While no studies exist of which I am aware, I would suspect that those who rely exclusively on local news outlets, on Clear Channel radio and TV broadcasts, and on Rupert Murdoch's media outlets, including Fox, are less likely to get a broad view of what's going on in the world than are those who get their news from a broader spectrum of resources. Writing in the New York Times last week, Paul Krugman said, this was before the acquisition of the Wall Street Journal, if Mr. Murdoch does acquire the Journal, it will be a dark day for America's news media and American democracy. If there were any justice in the world, Mr. Murdoch, who did more than anyone in the news business to mislead this country into an unjustified, disastrous war, would be a discredited outcast. Instead, he's expanding his empire. I suspect that most Latter-day Saints, like most Americans and probably most people, tend to get their information from a few homogeneous sources, those that tend to confirm and reinforce rather than challenge their established points of view. Number three, related to this is the tendency of Mormons to be unquestioning and too rigidly obedient to authority. Too great an emphasis on obedience can lead to blind obedience to both religious and secular leaders. That is, the tendency of Mormons to be compliant, unquestioning, and loyal in one arena makes it difficult for them to challenge and question in other arenas, including the political one. These attitudes are so deeply ingrained that for some Mormons, criticism of the president and other high-ranking officials is tantamount to speaking against the Lord's anointed. Such an attitude is reinforced, I believe, when Mormons hear church leaders express sentiments that seem to support government officials and policy. President Hinckley's statement shortly after the invasion of Afghanistan is an example. Quote, as citizens, we are under the direction of our respective national leaders. They have access to greater political and military intelligence than do the people generally. We now know, of course, how much that intelligence was manipulated to support the administration's decision to enter the war and how much it has been manipulated and managed to sustain it. President Hinckley's statement in General Conference right after the invasion of Iraq also undoubtedly influenced the attitude of members of the church. Quote, in a democracy, we can renounce war and proclaim peace. There is opportunity for dissent. Many have been speaking out and doing so emphatically. That is their privilege. However, we must all be mindful of another overriding responsibility. That is, he means to be subject to kings, presidents, rulers, obeying, honoring, and sustaining the law. So, he says, we must be mindful of another overriding responsibility, which, I may add, governs my personal feelings and dictates my personal loyalties in the present situation. And although he emphasized the word personal and the personal nature of his opinion, it was likely to have been interpreted by many members of the church as more than personal. In explaining the recent decline of support of the war among Latter-day Saints, Mormon blogger Guy Murray says, it is true that in general LDS members are more conservatives as a whole, but at one point the whole country backed this war, and this president, which isn't really true, not the whole country at least, there are a few of us who didn't, Over the years, the country has soured on this war, but Mormons may just be following the national trend. But, I ask, shouldn't we be leading rather than following such a trend? Number four, surprisingly, another way Mormon politicians, supported by a predominant sector of the Mormon electorate, have perpetuated the war is the supporting legislation to keep homosexuals out of the military. This has resulted, among other things, in the dismissal of a number of Arabic translators in a war in which the United States is dramatically deficient in translators, either in intelligence analysis or battlefield communication. Mormon politicians overwhelmingly supported the original Don't Ask, Don't Tell bill enacted in 1993 and have continued all efforts to overturn it since. This, in spite of the fact that the military forces of our primary partners in the Middle East conflict all welcome gays and lesbians openly into their fighting forces and have found no evidence that such a policy has negatively affected either performance or morale. In recent debates, both Democratic and Republican candidates for president, in these debates, all of the Democrats and none of the Republicans have favored overturning the current policy. When recently asked about this, Mormon Mitt Romney stated, "This is not the time to put in place a major change, a social experiment, in the middle of an ongoing war." But as stated, this experiment has already proved successful in a number of other countries. A fifth way in which we may have helped perpetuate the war is by not being sufficiently familiar with what the scriptures and the prophets have said about war. While the scriptures are somewhat ambivalent about war in general, the primary message of the New Testament, the Book of Mormon, and the Doctrine and Covenants is that war works against God's ultimate purposes, especially war that has begun as the present war was before all other options were exhausted. Hugh Nibley describes the free men in the Book of Mormon as being, quote, not militant. They made war with heavy reluctance. They were non-competitive and friendly, appealing to the power of the word above that of the sword. The condemnation of war by Latter-day Saint prophets is as clear as any uttered by the Lord's spokesman over the millennia. Let me cite just a few. During the First World War, President Joseph F. Smith stated, "For years it has been held that peace comes by preparation for war. The present conflict should prove that peace comes only by preparing for peace, through training the people in righteousness and justice," as Francis has talked about, "and selecting rulers who respect the righteous will of the people," end of quote. At present, the current administration not only disrespects the righteous will of the people in the United States and Iraq, the majority of whom in both countries support a withdrawal of American troops, it attempts to silence them. One could argue, in fact, that this is part of the administration's policy or strategy. As Chris Hedges says in War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning, a marvelous book, by the way, which I commend to you, Chris Hedges states, quote, "States at war silence their own authentic and humane culture. When this destruction is well advanced, they find the lack of critical and moral restraint useful in the campaign to exterminate the culture of their opponents. By destroying authentic culture, that which allows us to question and examine ourselves and our society, the state erodes the moral fabric. It is replaced with a warped version of reality. The enemy is dehumanized, the universe starkly divided between the forces of light and the forces of darkness, the us and them that Francis talked about." President Kimball warned against the inevitable result of a military-industrial complex. I didn't know until recently that what Eisenhower originally called this, and Congress put pressure on him to change it, was the military-industrial-congressional complex. And that is what it is. Anyway, President Kimball said, "We are a warlike people, easily detracted from our assignment of preparing for the coming of the Lord. When the enemies rise up, we commit vast resources to the fabrication of gods of stone and steel, ships, planes, missiles, fortifications, and depend on them for protection and deliverance. When threatened, we become anti-enemy instead of pro-kingdom of God. We train a man in the art of war and call him a patriot, thus in the manner of Satan's counterfeit of true patriotism, perverting the Savior's teaching." The cost of the war is something that is difficult to get your handle on. If you're like me, you kind of work in the realm of hundreds and sometimes thousands of dollars. Millions and billions are a little bit beyond the pale. But I read in the paper just this week that our lack of being prepared for this war has caused some of the military industrial complex now to create these iron fortress vehicles. And we can now, they're trying to decide, maybe they've already passed legislation, that we can get them there in a week for nearly $1 billion. Otherwise, it would take, a couple of weeks. Number six. Finally, I believe that as Latter-day Saints, we have helped perpetuate the war by considering that there is a divine design behind our nation's invasion of that far country and special providence in protecting Mormon soldiers engaged in the conflict. Again, something that Francis addressed. As I argued in my paper at last year's Sunstone Symposium, The Costs of Credulity, Mormon Urban Legends, and the War on Terror, Mormons who believe that God influenced are entering the war so that the priesthood could be restored to the ancient land of Abraham, and some actually believe that, and so that soldier missionaries could convert others to the gospel, are much less likely to question the war. That is, if this is part of God's design, who are we to challenge it? Which is part of President Bush's strategy as well. Just as such attitudes and behaviors may have contributed to perpetuating the war in Iraq, so I believe that Mormons could be influential in ending the war by being less partisan. And they could begin by reading Gene England's provocative essay, Why Utah Mormons Should Become Democrats. Second, by becoming and staying better informed about the war. Third, by being more critical of what the government says about the war. Four, by writing letters to their congressional representatives to change the Don't Ask, Don't Tell law. Fifth, by becoming more careful readers of what the scriptures and the prophets say about war. And sixth, by challenging our thinking that special providence is involved in starting and sustaining the war and in preserving the lives of Mormon soldiers. But we are to do more than end war. The Lord commands us in the Doctrine and Covenants, renounce war and proclaim peace, and diligently seek to turn the hearts of the children to their fathers and the hearts of their fathers to their children, echoing the scriptures about that from the Old Testament. Note the strength of these imperatives. Renounce, proclaim, diligently seek. Renouncing war does not mean silently sitting by while war does its destructive work. It means using our voices to counter those who argue for and support war. It means supporting those individuals, politicians, groups, and organizations committing to ending the war. I left one of my assignments recently on the High Council in the Santa Cruz stake and went next door to the Quaker meeting. It was a wonderful experience. During the entire hour we sat there, no one stood and said, the time is going to waste, and I just couldn't let it do so, and so I'm going to bear my testimony. Hugh Nibley says, renounce is a strong word. We are not to try to win peace by war or merely call a truce, but to renounce war itself, to disdain it as a policy, while proclaiming peace without reservation. Renouncing war and proclaiming peace also means that we recognize that as a nation, we have been responsible for the death and destruction we have both awakened and unleashed in that far country. We seem inured to the daily horror resulting from the war. With the administration allowing as little publicity as possible about our own dead, injured, and traumatized, we have been even more shielded from knowing the cost of the war for ourselves, let alone for the citizens of Iraq. The cost in the Treasury is nearing $500 billion, making this the most expensive war in U.S. history. Estimates of Iraqi deaths in the war range from 70,000 to 750,000. 750,000 is a much more reliable figure, I believe. It comes out of Johns Hopkins University. And there have been more than 2 million displaced or people have been displaced or become refugees. Recently, President Hinckley evidenced a more sober attitude toward the war. He reminded members of the church of the war's cost. Quote, nearly 10 decades have passed now since my birth, he said, and for the better part of that time there has been war among mankind in one part of the earth or another. No one can ever estimate the terrible suffering incident to these wars across the globe. Lives numbered in the millions have been lost. The terrible wounds of war have left bodies maimed and minds destroyed. Families have been left without fathers and mothers. Young people who have been recruited to fight have in many instances died, while those yet alive have had woven into the very fabric of their natures elements of hatred which will never leave. The treasure of nations have been wasted and will never be recovered. Our support for the war represents, most of all, what I call a failure of the Christian imagination. We don't often talk about what it means to have a Christian imagination. But for me, it means that we understand that the greatest power that Christ possessed was his ability to imagine each of us individually and all of us collectively. Imagine not only our potential glory, but also our real suffering and sinfulness. It was his ability to place our hearts and minds in his heart and mind, to become us in a sense, and through that becoming, to identify, understand, and empathize with us. Such identification, understanding, and empathy, coupled with his inexhaustible love, motivated him to take upon himself our infirmities and iniquities. As we attempt to take on us his nature, just as he took ours, we cultivate and then ultimately possess a capacity to imagine the lives of others, especially in their suffering. With such an imagination, we grieve not only for the families of the 3,500 American soldiers who have lost their lives and the tens of thousands of Americans who have been wounded in the war, many of them severely so, but for all of those Iraqis and others who have been killed and wounded, many as a result of our own bombs and shells. Imagine more than 200 times as many Iraqis as American deaths. With such empathetic imaginations, we should be brokenhearted each day by the news from Basra, Bakuba, and Baghdad that one more child or a dozen have been killed, that a grandfather has had to bury his entire family killed by a roadside bomb or a misguided coalition shell, or that a Muslim holy place has been destroyed, that rivers and streams have been polluted by munitions, and that the civil war escalates daily, increasingly destroying the hope for a favorable outcome. We who are often fearful of sending our own children to school along our streets and through our neighborhoods might imagine what it would be like to send our children to school or to the market, knowing that bombs go off in our city every day. It is our indifference to such things that may constitute our greatest sin. As Simon Sharma says in his commentary on Picasso's great anti-war painting, Guernica, quote, "The routine that Guernica tears into is the sickness of our own as well as Picasso's time, the habit of taking violent evil in our stride, the yawn of the massacre, seen it before, go away. Guernica isn't with us for fun. It's there to rip away the scar tissue, to make us bleed, to rob us of our sleep, so what we cannot do when the bombs start dropping, it can instruct us in the obligation of being human." Not only the obligation of being human, I would add, but for us, the responsibility of being Christian. Helen Whitley noted in her keynote address on Wednesday night that Mormons have a disproportionate share of the wealth, power, and influence in this country. Were we to use that wealth, power, and influence, I believe we could hasten the end of this war and thus change the calculus of the Middle East and ultimately in the larger world. Instead of being the chief supporters of the war, we could become the chief supporters of the peace, which, as Christ's disciples, is among our highest calling. Let me close with two statements from Presidents of the Church. The first from President Joseph F. Smith, suggesting something about our particular responsibility as Latter-day Saints. While it is only the one power, and there is one power and one power only that can prevent war among the nations of the world, and that is true religion and undefiled before God the Father, nothing else will accomplish it. And so I repeat that there is but one remedy that can prevent men from going to war when they feel disposed to do it, and that is the Spirit of God, which inspires us to love, not to hate, and which leads to all truth and not to hatred. There is only one thing that can bring peace in the world. It is the adoption of the gospel of Jesus Christ, rightly understood, obeyed, and practiced by rulers and peoples alike. And there's no question that President Smith means members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And he says, it is being preached in power to all nations, kindred, tongues, and peoples of the world by the Latter-day Saints. And the day is not far distant when its message of salvation shall seep deep into the hearts of the common people, who in sincerity and in earnestness, when the time comes, will not only surely register their judgment against a false Christianity, but will also register it against war and the makers of war as crimes against the human race. On the eve of the Second World War, as the storm clouds were gathering over Europe, President Heber J. Grant stated, "We affirm that all international controversies may be settled by pacific means if nations will but deal unselfishly and righteously with one another. We appeal to the leaders of all nations and to the people themselves to thus mend and adjust their differences. We further declare that God is grieved by war, and that he will hold subject to the eternal punishments of his will those who wage it unrighteously." After the war had started, but before the United States entered it, he added, and I think this is very relevant for today. "Now I pray," said President Grant, for the Lord to bless the Latter-day Saints. I pray the Lord to bless the people of the world. I pray with all my heart, and would that any man, I don't care who he is or how high his position, who is doing anything to get us into war, that he may be confounded. And I pray that we will all pray for guidance with all our hearts and souls. I feel as though it might be well for the Latter-day Saints to set aside a day to fast and pray and ask the Lord to preserve us as a nation from getting us into this war. I would like to suggest something radical. That we recognize how much our own greed, pride, and ambition have contributed to the current situation in which we find ourselves, including the growing hostility not only in the Islamic world, but globally. Our willingness to look the other way as our government has undermined and overthrown democratically elected governments, sided with kings and oligarchs. Now, the irony is that we are now enemies with Iran, and a generation ago, Iran elected a democratic president. The CIA undermined and had him overthrown and brought in the Shah so we could get the oil, and we are reaping the whirlwind. Our willingness to look the other way as our government has undermined and overthrown democratic elected governments, sided with kings and oligarchs to satisfy our lust for their natural resources, always at the expense of the citizens in those countries, and our indifference to other religions and cultures have contributed to the quagmire in which we currently find ourselves. Before we can have lasting peace, we need to repent of such policies and practices and ask forgiveness of those whom we have harmed by them. Finally, I would like to suggest something even more radical. That we love our enemies, including Osama bin Laden and his murderous associates. I've been struck in my recent reading of the Book of Mormon by how those Nephite and Lamanites striving to be Christ-like responded to their enemies in the Book of Mormon, not with contempt, but with compassion, not with loathing, but with love. Although some Lamanites and some Nephite dissenters plunder, enslave, and wage all too frequent war against the Nephites, the more noble Nephites refuse to respond in kind. In spite of the damage and destruction they experience at the hands of the Lamanites, in spite of the fact that the Lamanites seek their utter destruction, the Nephites continue to try and heal the fraternal bonds, speaking of the Lamanites always as, quote, their beloved brethren, forgiving them easily and often, and continually trying to persuade them to make peace. This principle is reflected in a 1981 Christmas message from the First Presidency. To all who seek a resolution to conflict, be it a misunderstanding between individuals or international difficulty among nations, we command the counsel of the Prince of Peace. Love your enemies, bless them that curse you, do good to them that hate you, and pray for them which despitefully use you and persecute you, that you may be the children of your Father which is in heaven. This principle of loving one another as Jesus Christ loves us will bring peace to the individual, to the home, and beyond, even to the nations of the world. I keep imagining what would happen if President Bush were to forge domestic and foreign policy based on such attitudes. What might happen were he to go before the United Nations and say something like the following: "My brothers and sisters throughout the world, as one of your number, I'm asking that we be united as nations, consider that we as United Nations consider establishing an international year of peace and reconciliation. In the coming year, let us put all of our weapons aside and work together for peace. As President of the United States, I pledge our willingness to cease hostilities wherever our armed forces are found. I am asking that American soldiers stand down, and I am asking you to have yours do the same. I know that many will say that this is impossible, that it's suicidal, that it can't possibly work. I know there will be great resistance to such an idea, especially from those who profit from war or who see war as the only option to obtain their objectives. But I have come to see finally that war itself is suicidal. Ultimately, its cost is too high. As a prelude to this year of peace and reconciliation, I ask the forgiveness of you and your people for the things I and my country have done that have been harmful to you. I acknowledge that we have made many grave mistakes, and that to a considerable degree, much of the trouble of the world is a result of our pride, our arrogance, and our greed. We ask your forgiveness. We also offer forgiveness to those who have harmed us. Let this be a year in which we purge ourselves of those things that divide us and embrace those things that unite us. Let us forge a new policy that creates a more equitable world, one that recognizes that, as the poet W.H. Auden said during the Second World War, we must love one another or die. To indicate our commitment to this year of reconciliation and peace, I'm asking the American people and Congress to pledge $1 trillion to support those efforts that renounce war and proclaim peace. To further this work with Congress's approval, I am creating a new cabinet-level position, Secretary of Peace. As a religious nation, one that combines the wisdom and spiritual strength of the world's faith traditions, I believe this is what God calls us to do. The ultimate message of the Book of Mormon is that we should, quote, come unto Christ and be perfected in him, and deny ourselves of all ungodliness, including the ungodliness of war, and love God with all of our might, mind, and strength. Making peace is one of the chief ways in which we can come unto him and show our love for God and our fellow beings. Thank you.
We'd like to open the floor now to comments and questions. If you would like to make comments, ask questions, please.
I truly believe in what you said about using the language of peace and the action of peace and how we treat each other, especially our enemies. We're struggling with this. We've become so numb to the manipulations and lies and twisted language of this administration to the point where Larry King can sit down with the vice president last week and ask him these questions and ask him, do you have any regrets? And the vice president can say no, and say he would still invade Iraq again. And Larry King can still sit there as if he was talking to a human being instead of a war criminal. And that's who these men are war criminals. And yet we still, what I'm struggling with is, how do we be honest about what has happened, which is criminal behavior and lying and twisting of this language, and yet still engage them, and also especially Mormons. Next year we're going to be talking about the Book of Mormon gospel doctrine. How can we in gospel doctrine classes be honest about what we have done and what we can do in following the Book of Mormon? How can we do it in a positive way without the conversation and threatening fellow Mormons with, you're like, oh, we can't talk about politics or our administration's behavior.
We TiVo the Daily Show, and some of you may have seen what Jon Stewart said about Cheney and King, that interview about them being something of a walking poster for a cardiac hospital or something like that. I think the only thing we can do is the problem in a way is that the manipulation leads to people starting to say, well, questioning their own reality. You know, maybe they're right. We hear it so often. The number of people, including the number of Mormons, who believe that we went into Iraq because Saddam Hussein was partly responsible for 9/11. The fact that so many people believe that, but if you repeat something often enough, a certain percentage of people. So preserve your ability to question and to challenge. It is, again, particularly difficult for Latter-day Saints to do that because in one arena we don't do that very much or do that very easily. So I would say do that. And with the Book of Mormon, be willing to ask those questions in gospel doctrine class or in any place else. Be willing in your prayers, pray for the people of Iraq and pray for the people in Darfur. It's surprising that nobody does. You know, listen to the prayers in your congregation. We pray for the sick and the afflicted and those in authority and the missionaries, but we never get beyond that, or seldom do. So I would say, you know, in response to you, and of course, read your dad's book again. One of our great peacemakers is Mark England. Yeah.
I'd like to explain, first of all, that I am considered probably quite a liberal in my ward, I suppose, because I'm a moderate Utah Democrat. I agree with the Democratic Party nationally that there have been some misleading information about our presence and the handling of the whole expedition in Iraq has been terribly mishandled. And the attitude has been like a gunslinger and not in a Christian manner at all. However, I wouldn't want to see us get so far removed from the reality of some of our recent history. And when President Grant was talking about staying out of World War II, it sounded like, you know, maybe something could be done with the dialogue with Adolf Hitler. And it seems to me that Neville Chamberlain made a great effort to do that. And yet, some people attribute his pacifistic Christian attitude resulting into the occupation of the state land and the invasion of Poland. So how far can we go with this attitude of Christianity? Have we gone to the... Do we not really have much choice of waiting and dialoguing before we went to Afghanistan to try to hunt for the person who illegally and against humanity killed 6,000 people?
Those are good questions. They're honest questions, and I would, you know, try to respond to them quickly because I know there are other questions. As Gene England pointed out, what happened in the Second World War was a result of our lack of Christian treatment of the Germans after the First World War. We laid the scene and set the seeds for that kind of reaction because we were so harsh and so repressive of the German people. And so in some sense, you know, where do you end that? The problem with peace is that it's so seldom tried as a first strategy. We did not have a dialogue. We did not attempt to have a dialogue. And again, I think that to keep in mind that we are not completely innocent of what happened on 9/11. And I don't by any means wish to overstate this, but the resentment in many Muslim countries because we have gone in and made pacts with the leaders of those countries. We've gotten oil cheap. The common people have basically been, you know, they have not gotten their own natural resources. We've been very selfish. So it could begin by that kind of introspection. And the other thing is that we wage war, if we have to, as Francis said, and as Hugh Nibley said, with great reluctance. We are not triumphal. We don't talk about how, shock and awe. We talk about regret. I mean, how terrible. I don't know if you read about this family of Afghanis, a number of them, grandparents, parents, children, 30 or 40 of them gathered for a wedding. Our false intelligence caused us to bomb them and kill them all. I mean, how can we ever feel good about that kind of thing? So it is a complicated world. I think that easy, quick answers are to be distrusted. You're right to suggest the complexity, but I think the people talk about, how can this happen, and yet a little brown Indian man brought the greatest empire on earth to its knees by fasting and praying and being true to his Hindu principles. So I think it's possible, but it is complicated, and I appreciate the challenge of your question. Yeah, Francis.
From the doctor host in San Francisco that thinks that we're going to go to war with Iran very soon, sometime between mid-November before Christmas. And he thinks that the logic, and he has people call in, and been in the government, been in the Republican Party around the country. They say that Cheney's pretty discouraged with the Seven Dwarfs, as he calls them, running, and he thinks that if we get another war going and get the nation behind it, he can step in and knock everybody out and get elected. Karl Rove's first thing to get us in was this, it was set up 2004, and then we could get out, and then we could go back to our lives, and everything would be hunky-dory. But Bush and Cheney really aren't messianic, and if they think this will get Cheney elected in 2008, do you see that happening, that they'll attack Iran during that timeline that predicts? Do you think members of the church will back Cheney? He is from Wyoming, and if this happens, maybe they'll back him over Romney.
A Hobson's choice, perhaps. There. I seriously doubt, and certainly more sincerely hope, that we are not that foolish to go into Iran. As I stated, we had our chance to support a democratic elected government there, and what we produced is something so far from that it's terrible. But I hope that doesn't happen. Francis, you want to answer some questions? Go ahead.
Support what you've said. The last time I dared to say this in a group performance was that I was in Cleon Scalzo's class at BYU, and it was during some Israeli war, and I asked a whole lot about the Palestinian children in my guiding fashion, and there was a whole row of men in suits on the front, his little army there who took down my name and address. And ever since then, I haven't said anything, but I have been, in church meetings where there's come another war. And anyone who has suggested that an Arab might be your brother has been, they've just been shut up. So I think that's true, that we have perpetuated this thing, and we have a lot to answer for. And I can't hold myself up as a great example, but when after 9/11, I took my son to the local madrasa, and we learned Arabic because I felt like we needed to learn to speak to our brothers and sisters in other places in the world. And I'm proud to say that my son is now studying Middle East studies at the University of Chicago. But I just wanted to support you.
Hey, what's your first name? And the next time somebody asks for your name and address, say, it's Ann Hinckley, and I live at 47 East South Temple Street.
Great.
Yes.
I have just been thrilled to listen to your comments, well presented.
And I represent your other brothers and sisters, Christian brothers and sisters in this community, particularly people with the World Council of Churches who have stood up to this administration since before we went to war. My great dream would be that the Mormon Church and those of you who have these feelings, instead of going off and doing another program of your own, would join with us and break down some of the barriers that are there between our denominations to show that you truly are one Christian community. And your voice, your joining with the existing programs that are out there that are trying so hard and working so tirelessly would be so welcome.
Thank you so much for that. It's something that I firmly believe. For a period of time, I was a representative for the church on interfaith councils in the Santa Cruz area. And it was one of the most meaningful experiences of my life. And, you know, essentially because of Marion D. Hanks, the church has moved much more toward that. But we still tend to be the one and only true church and don't join with those others. I hope very much that people will join, because the World Council of Churches, the Episcopal Church, the Methodist Church, the Lutheran Church, so many of these people have aggressive, active Christian programs to try and stop the war and to bring peace. So thank you for that. Janine.
Well, a couple of weeks ago, I had a Temple Recommend interview with the bishop, and I told him that I was really disappointed in the lack of moral leadership by the church, and he was kind of taken aback by that. And I explained that it seemed like the only moral issues that they wanted to discuss or to speak out on were sexual issues, and that I felt that there were so many greater moral issues that, you know, needed their statements. And in an authoritarian church like ours, just one little statement from President Hinckley would just change 95% of the attitudes in the church. And I'm wondering, you know, what can we do practically to voice our beliefs to them, to get them to make a difference? Because I think their silence is really a moral failure. And, you know, we tried the online petition about the Cheney talk at BYU. That didn't do any good. But I'm wondering, I mean, should we march around Temple Square? Should we do another petition? You know, give us some practical things that we can do to change that.
Doctrine and Covenant says that we should do many things of our own free will and choice. It's difficult for me to, you know, since we're in the same ward, I'm happy to work with you, and we're fortunate to have a good bishop. Good luck getting it signed higher up. I think, you know, the worst thing is to think that we can't make a difference. I remember during the Vietnam War, when I was teaching at UCLA, Arthur Henry King, who was a new convert to the church, one of the distinguished converts that we've had, this was, you know, Cambodia and Kent and all kinds of things were around. I was trying to do some things on the UCLA campus to demonstrate for peace and to end the war. And I remember I was very discouraged. I remember picking Arthur up at the airport to bring him to a lecture at UCLA. And I was saying, you know, I don't know if I'm making any difference or not. I'm doing this and that and the other, but I'm really discouraged. And he said, Bob, you have to believe that you can always make a difference. Whatever you do can make a difference. So I think, first of all, it's believing that. Working in the Santa Cruz area for people, whether they're in the church or not, for doing that. The church, you know, Arthur and I had a long discussion today about how, you know, whether or not it's able to penetrate that. I believe it is. I believe, by my very limited experience and friendship with a couple of general authorities, that I would say that I think most of them want to have peace. I think most of them want to do what's best for the church. I think it's very hard in the kind of structure we have and the kind of tradition we have to make radical change. One of them said to me, a member of the Quorum of the Twelve said to me a couple of years ago, he said, we can't get anything done in the church. He said, I'm not complaining, but I am lamenting. So it's difficult. But I think to believe that we can keep doing it is important. Please.
Google that name and you'll find out that it's an organization of women. It was started many years ago actually in Israel, and with Palestinian and Israeli women just couldn't stand it, and they stand in silence, women in black standing in silence for peace, and once a week we put on black and we have these big signs and we just stand on a street corner and cars go by and we don't engage with anybody. It's been really helpful to me to do that. We get a lot of positive horn honking, and we get filthy things shouted at us, mostly by men when it's filthy. But anyway, we've been on the news a few times. They see the banner. I feel like it's something. And then I have a bumper sticker. I thought I would get my car vandalized, but I haven't. You know, and then another thing I've done is, it's a little thing, but I'm attending an Episcopal church this year with a six-year-old grandson whose parents don't want him raised Mormon, so I volunteered to raise him in the Episcopal church. And I started praying for my enemies. Now I believe that there is no them and us. I agree with you, there is no them and us, it's just us. But Jesus did say, love your enemies. So I started praying for my enemies, and it's a conservative Episcopal church that has made people upset. So then at the sign of peace, whatever priest came over to me, when I shook their hand, I said, I want to pray for our enemies. I want to pray for our enemies. And I was just such a pain in the butt. And eventually, one day I was at church, and he said, and yes, we must pray for our enemies. But, you know, sure. Just do whatever you can.
I had to stand up. I love the women in black. We have them. We have them on the Oregon coast. I have joined Code Pink. I don't know if any of you are familiar with Code Pink. And we march. And I don't know whether this does any good or not. But there is a saying by Gandhi that I have reproduced 150 times because I want everyone here to have one, and I'm going to have them all out there on the news, which says this: peacemaking. Whatever you do will be insignificant, but it is very important that you do it. And that's the only thing, you know, when they say, what do you do? That's what keeps me going. I went to Washington for a couple of months and with the Clergy Leadership Network, and it didn't, you don't know. I mean, you can't see that it does anything. Whatever you do will be insignificant, but it is very important that you do it. So hold these to your heart, that's all.
Okay, thank you, Francis. Before I get Glenn's question, let me just tell you a very quick story about two Mormon Latter-day Saint attitudes or responses to the war. One is Jay Bybee. Jay Bybee, along with John Yoo, Jay Bybee is a Latter-day Saint attorney who helped craft the torture policy of this government. And he's now on the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in San Francisco. Alyssa Peterson is a returned missionary from Holland, Latter-day Saint woman, who learned Arabic, who became a translator for the United States government as a soldier in Iraq, who was so disturbed by what was happening in the prison, one of the prison camps where she was a translator, and the brutality being done to the prisoners, that she objected to it, to the interrogation techniques that were being used, and refused to participate in it after two nights of working in a unit known as the Cage. She is said to have committed suicide. We don't know. An Army spokesman for her unit had refused to describe the interrogation techniques Alyssa objected to. They say all the records of the techniques have now been destroyed. I thought you would be interested in kind of a contrasting response. Glenn?
I have a question. Because I think we're all converted, probably were. And first of all, I would just like to thank both of you for caring and for making a difference. I thought your speech was wonderfully, had a wonderful metaphor of poetic. Yours always do. And what I admire about both of you is that you walk the walk.
Thank you.
The question to either of you, you raised an interesting issue on specifics, because I think most of us are in the choir here. And then it has to do with partisanship. I'm more concerned because you said you brought up the dynamics of Mormon being obedient. But I suspect if the other party were in power, there would be less support. And so you're interesting in that you talked about both metaphorically, psychologically, and also politically how partisan we become.
Yep.
I would like...
On both sides.
On both sides, but also within our culture, we have become more partisan.
Yeah.
My statement is, it would seem to me that it is dangerous to deify our politics, and both, we've done that a great deal in the country, but I see some change in the religious right in questioning that. In Mormonism, I see partisanship as very strong, and at least in my reading of BYU polls, except for the partisan, not decreasing. If partisanship is part of the issue, what do we do about that?
That's a very good question, and I've also seen some of those polls that suggest that it is increasing, and certainly in some places it is. I think in some ways the best example we can set is to be nonpartisan ourselves, which is very difficult. So often partisanship evokes a counterpartisanship. So to be respectful of people who differ, to be respectful of the other side, to be willing to engage in dialogue, to listen, to to consider, certainly to be humble. It seems to me that there is such an absolute lack of humility in our present policies and the stance of our government that we as individuals should be humble in that regard. So try not to be as partisan as the people you think are too partisan.
Right?
Okay, Ron.
For the people,
it works.
It's not working. Well, it's a suggestion for people who live around Salt Lake. I drive in and out of here quite a bit, and I often listen to KSL, a station I sort of consider our church station. And they have about 6 hours of programming every day that ridicules efforts to end the war. They and you might call them. I've tried several times to get into Doug Wright, who spends 3 hours making fun of Harry Reid sometimes in the mornings. And it's interesting that he's a Mormon, a Western Mormon, and there's not much sentiment.
Well, but one of the things
in trying to end the war.
One of the things to keep in mind is that there are some people with whom you can have a dialogue, and other people that, as Paul says, is like talking into the air. There are some people who simply will not ever listen, and you'll never change their mind. It horrified me not long ago to learn that Glenn Beck is a convert to the church. Let me just close. It is time, anyone who wants to come, let me close by quoting something that Isaiah said. Isaiah, and this is really going back to the idea of our imagination. Isaiah said, "The world will be filled with the glory of God as waters cover the sea." N.T. Wright says, "We are called to live between the vision of the world which is already filled with the glory of God and the world which is yet to be filled with the glory of God as the waters cover the sea." It's a fascinating phrase. How do the waters cover the sea? They are the sea. God intends to flood the world with himself, with his love in fresh ways, in which what we already know of the beauty and power and majesty of creation will be taken up and enhanced yet further. One of the fresh ways, my brothers and sisters, in which God intends to flood the world with his love is through us, through our imaginations, as we seek peace through his Son, the Prince of Peace. Thank you.